Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, the Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
And thank you for coming on, Chris, because obviously something happened with Coletta Gull and a devastating new book, The Wrong Enemy, America in Afghanistan, 2001-2014, does bring out the headlines came from that book was that the head of Pakistan's military intelligence, General Pasha, knew of bin Laden's presence in Pakistan. And apparently there was a special desk, the bin Laden desk, secretly set up at the ISI. What's your understanding of and the sourcing on that?
So, look, I have a lot of respect for Coletta Gull. I mean, her work is simply unparalleled in terms of the time on the ground, the quality of the rigor, and quite frankly, the ballsiness of her work. So I have great respect and admiration for her. On this point, however, I am quite dubious that this went up to Pasha. I think if I were bin Laden or if you were bin Laden, you wouldn't want DGISI knowing about this because you could never know how reliable the successor will be. They could sell you if the price was right. So you would just never know from your own operational security if you could rely upon the DGISI. I think there's a different explanation, and that is that Pakistan has many blackwaters. It has multiple networks of retired intelligence operatives, retired military personnel, and they use these blackwater-like contractors in the same way that we do. So it's entirely possible that one of these blackwater-like networks were in charge of overseeing bin Laden. And this would make sense. So if any question came up within the military intelligence or the ISI or even the intelligence bureau or the special branch of the police, it would eventually get bounced back to, oh, yeah, this particular Blackwater is handling that house. Don't worry about it. That makes more sense to me than this idea that there was a desk to handle bin Laden at the ISI. I'm very skeptical of that claim.
But in general, though, in terms of a country that has received $30 billion or close to $30 billion of U.S. aid since 9/11, has state-sponsored terrorism under a nuclear umbrella, and yet somehow, and by the way, is responsible for the deaths of, largely responsible to my mind at least, of the deaths of 2,300 Americans and 1,000 NATO soldiers in Afghanistan. We treat that country as though it's an ally, and their diplomats and their ISI people over here are given visas. Here we are, as we pointed out in the earlier interview about this UN denying this Iranian diplomat a UN because the House and Senate are calling him a terrorist because he translated for the students who took over the U.S. Embassy back in 1979. So isn't that a glaring double standard? I mean, you know.
Oh, Ian, you and I have violently agreed on this over the last, 11 years. You know, I often ask my students in class, let's do a counterfactual. In 2001, Khatami was the president of Iran. He was incredibly supportive of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. At Bonn, which is where the interim constitution was drafted for Karzai, it was the Iranian representative that insisted upon democracy. And, of course, how Iran was rewarded for this was being included in the Axis of Evil speech. If we could go back to 2001, and if we could have capitalized upon what Khatami was proposing, and if we had worked with Iran to move logistics through the Chabahar port and the lines of control that the Indians had already built linking Chabahar to Afghanistan, we'd be in a different place. But when you suggest this, people go ballistic, and they say, well, Iran is a nuclear proliferator and it supports terrorism. Bullocks. There is no amount of terrorism and no amount of proliferation that Iran has done that Pakistan hasn't done more of. And to your point, I was actually just at the State Department today, and I asked them the same question, Ian. I said, $30 billion later, they are responsible for our troops dying in Afghanistan, both to the Taliban and groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba. Why are they not declared a state that sponsors terrorism? Instead, they're completely feted here. And, you know, and there's a lot of suspicion, and I would say our views are shared by many within the intelligence community, parts of DOD, but the State Department is where all of this pro-Pakistani sentiment lies. And it is absolutely enraging. And I'm grateful that you've brought out this point that $30 billion later, they're the ones killing our troops, not Al-Qaeda. But I think the average American doesn't understand this.
So why then do you think we can't call it as it is? I mean, you think it is the State Department? I mean, and surely Obama, you know, who obviously, at least if you believe the White House's narrative, recognized that he couldn't let the Pakistanis know that they were going to invade their airspace and grab bin Laden. Unlike Bush before him, who would just get on the phone and talk to Musharraf, and probably would have telegraphed the raid had he been in the White House. So, and of course, then bin Laden would have been mysteriously whisked away, as happened earlier when the cruise missiles came into his hideout in Afghanistan after 9/11. So, what's your understanding of this extraordinary denial that goes on in the face of overwhelming evidence?
So I think it really comes down to Pakistan's nuclear weapons program. So basically, Pakistan holds the whole world hostage because of its nuclear weapons and its threat, its constant threat to proliferate, both to other countries, as it did in the 90s, of course, to Iran most prominently, but most specifically, proliferating within its own program. It has been very vocal that it is pursuing what they'll call battlefield nuclear weapons, which are essentially what we would call tactical nuclear weapons. And this raises all sorts of concerns about command and control. Will terrorists get a hold of these small nuclear weapons? Because in fact, once they're out in the field, they become much more difficult to control. And the Pakistanis know this, and the Pakistanis know that we know this. And so they basically manipulate this fear so that the Americans will want to continue to have a large presence in Afghanistan, a large presence in Pakistan. And to have a large presence justified, you have to, with, you know, spies in the embassy, you have to have a large aid program. And so a lot of this comes down to the American inability to find some way of extricating itself from this coercion loop. And I think there's also organizations like USAID, which has really benefited from this nonsensical narrative that terrorists are poor and they're uneducated, and if we just, you know, lift them out of poverty and educate them, they'll be less vulnerable to terrorism. USAID has benefited tremendously from this narrative. Its programming in Pakistan is bloated, it's oversized, it's unproductive, it contributes to massive corruption. And so you have on the inside several organizations that really benefit directly from this narrative of trying to keep the Pakistanis in game. And so I think that's a relatively long-winded answer for why the State Department is constantly going to Congress and trying to get Congress to appropriate larger amounts, resist cutting Pakistan off altogether. Secretary Kerry very quietly and surreptitiously sought a waiver on Pakistan's security requirements to get Kerry Lugar Berman money. Not a single American newspaper reported on it. That's how quiet they were about it. The only paper that picked up on it was an Indian newspaper.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So just turning to the other disastrous and dysfunctional relationship that the U.S. has with the other of our so-called allies, the Afghan president, Karzai, who Obama inherited from Bush. But nevertheless, Karzai was allowed to win the rigged 2009 election after having lost the first round. And in Carlotta Gall's new book, The Wrong Enemy, she points out that when Karzai was forced to admit he had failed to win the first round of the elections, she apparently was there when he got the news, and she was there with John Kerry, who was then head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, quoting her book, "I watched Karzai's face that day in private with John Kerry. I knew he would not forgive America for the humiliation." What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's truthful. But, you know, I was watching this election. I was there as an election observer in 2009, and I had been there a number of times previous to that. And what's probably important to note is that the Bush administration was engaging in a whole series of activities that directly contributed to Karzai's rigging that election. Karzai had set up this thing called the Independent Local Governance Directorate. And this was directly funded by USAID. The IDLG was a mechanism that Karzai used to put into place district and provincial officials that would be pivotal to rigging his election. When Obama won the presidency and realized that this election was already, that the train had sailed on this election being rigged, there really wasn't much that could be done about it. And so if you were a Karzai, you could be a little bit surprised that, you know, the previous administration went so far as to help you rig your election. And now you've got this guy, Obama, who's basically dragging you behind the bus. Obama, you know, came out of the box really disliking Karzai. And his reasons for disliking him were quite legitimate. You know, if you believe all the counterinsurgency rubbish that's been sold around this town, by the way, I don't, you know, it was very clear that you simply can't win with a partner that's running this corrupt, kleptonarcocracy.
Well, but I know you don't get do-overs in foreign relations, but it would seem to me that this would be the ultimate do-over. If Ambassador Peter Galbraith was fired by his boss, the head of the UN, who decided to side with Karzai against Peter Galbraith in calling it the election the fraud that it was, and having a second round, which Abdullah apparently had won the first round at any rate. He's the guy that's perhaps the front runner now. Wouldn't we have had a whole different situation? You couldn't have done worse than Karzai, right?
Well, look, so we can blame Karzai for many, many things, but I'm going to go back to some other fundamental points. Much of the corruption that we blame Karzai for, we created. So I don't know if you were following some reporting that came out a few months ago. There were some documents that were leaked that the Zalmay Khalilzad embassy had been paying several of Karzai's NSC staffers a completely illegal additional salary from the U.S. government so that we could basically be spying on Karzai. All of these contracts that we have at these, you know, had to run the provincial reconstruction teams, this was just corruption on a stick. We were throwing money at what we called strongmen. If we didn't like them, they were warlords. So a lot of this corruption that we blame Karzai for, I think, has a lot to do with how the international community, through each of their own domestic incentives and preferences, wanted to shove money through this country that couldn't handle it. So I think what we're really experiencing is obviously his own personal ineptitude, but also we're experiencing the consequences of our own ineptitude. Like, let's take USAID, for example. So we can look at the outright numbers that USAID has so-called allocated to Afghanistan. 90 cents per dollar is estimated to have come back to the United States in contractor fees.
Oh, that's an outrage.
Well, it's a total outrage.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here.
Hey, great. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
You too. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The headline written down.